This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So welcome to Pardes Wednesday, summer evening lecture series. My name is Yiska Smith. I'm an adjunct faculty member here. I also teach as a conservative yeshiva. I have a private spiritual mentoring practice, and I'm a public speaker traveling all over the world. And pretty much everything I do addresses, I employ spiritual teachings, what has been what we now call redemptive Torah. It's pieces of text that invite you gently, with compassion, into considering a consciousness shift. So in addition to the actual rigor of moving through text, there's also an underpinning, there's a message that addresses a consciousness shift. These are the spiritual teachings. And I teach to authentic living, the spiritual dimension of authentic living. What does it mean to really be one with oneself, one with God, one with the rest of the world? And in that vein, what I'm going to share tonight is how to really restore unity in a fragmented world. And it all will lead up to a meditation that I'm going to guide you through towards the end on saying the Shema. That one sentence, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. So we need a good hour of moving through some ideas and insights and text leading up to that. My goal is when you leave tonight, you'll be able to take something with you. A technique, a shift perhaps in your own consciousness of how to navigate through a fragmented world. And I think all of us would agree, you know the saying, when there's two Jews, there's three opinions. However, I think when it comes to this, we all can agree in one way or another that the world needs some repair. A real tikkun olam, a real sense of redemptive Torah to guide us through a fragmented space. Okay. Now, what I've done, before I hand out the text, it won't be for about another 15 minutes, but I did distribute blank paper with pens. I encourage you to take notes. Even though this is called a lecture series, I did not want to distribute one big handout and read off of it. I can't do that. That's just not how I teach. I like to be interactive and engaging with whoever is listening. So therefore, by you taking notes, that's your way of taking home whatever it is I'm saying that resonates with you in particular. What I've also done, I provided on the board here words that I'll be referring to in the Hebrew, because I'm talking to a diverse group with all different levels of Hebrew, and while the text itself is an English adaptation of the Hebrew, I do feel to preserve the integrity of text study, I provided here the key words that we'll be discussing. And I'll be using this board. This is a working board. If you want to jot down any of the words as we move through it, I would encourage you to do that. Okay. Any questions before we begin? Wonderful to have you all here. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy, busy day. Everyone's busy all the time. When you ask anyone, how are you? I'm so busy. I am so busy. So I really appreciate, on behalf of Pardes, that you're here. So I want to open up the evening by asking a question for a few minutes. When you hear the phrase, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Now we know this is a very important sentence. Actually, in the Jewish tradition, if a person knows they're about to leave to the next world, we are taught that that's what we say. And that's hence we have the custom at night before we go to sleep to say the Shema at night, because we don't know which world we'll wake up in the morning. So just in case we wake up in the next world, we would have said the Shema. So it's quite, of all the different proclamations, the different verses, it's messaging to us that it's important. I would like one, two, most three people, if you can, or regular chatz, as we say, what does saying the Shema mean to you? When you say the Shema, what are you saying, if you so want to share with us? Is there anyone in the back there, please?
For an individual
could you speak a little louder?
Yeah. Through an individual declaration, I'm linking myself to a communal narrative.
Wow. So through an individual proclamation, you're joining a...
communal narrative.
A communal narrative. Beautiful. Wow, thank you. Can you see... Because we can move the table over here. Why don't we do that? Yeah, why don't we do that? We can do that in 2 minutes. Less than 2 minutes. Let's just bring this right over here. Here we go. Okay. Don't worry, I'll move around. I'm not shy. Okay, thank you for that. That's beautiful. Does anyone else have an insight they want to share? When you say Shema, what are you saying?
That I and my community believe in like a unified God, and that comes a lot of responsibility.
That you're with your community, the belief in the unified God, and with that comes responsibilities. Wonderful, yes. By the way, there's no right or wrong answer. When I say yes, thank you for sharing that. That's beautiful. One more. Do we have one more volunteer?
So I'm going to take a guess here. My father just passed away, and I was with him when he said Shema before he died.
Wow.
And so it strikes me that it connects. It connects you to the past and quite possibly to the future.
I can really personally relate to that because a little over 2 years ago, my mom crossed over to the other world. But it's still fresh, so I'm with you. I share that space with you. Okay, what I'd like to do, and this is not on the handout, so this is for you to listen and take notes, and then I'll distribute the handout. I want to provide a context within which to understand the one. The word echad. So, there is a tradition from the Baal Shem Tov that after Tisha B'Av, which is next week, the month is referred to as Menachem Av. It moves from Av to Menachem Av, which literally means, you would know this because you recently suffered this grief, Menachem is from Nechama, like Menachem Avel, to comfort the mourner. This is Menachem the Father, the consolation of the Father, emphasizing the aspect of God as Avinu rather than Malkenu, because we say Avinu Malkenu, our Father, our King. So emphasizing the aspect that God is our Father, after Tisha B'Av there's a shift where there's a consolation. Literally, Menachem Av means the consolation of the Father. Now, one of the sources for this tradition is based in the Haftarah that is read on the Shabbat after Tisha B'Av. From Sefer Yeshayahu, from the book of Isaiah, chapter 40, the first 26 verses in chapter 40. It begins with the words, Nachamu, Nachamu, comfort you, comfort you. So hence, the Shabbat after Tisha B'Av is referred to as Shabbat Nachamu, referring to God consoling his people for their suffering. However, regarding the name of the month transforming from Av to Menachem Av, this is not so clear. Who is consoling whom? What is the consolation? Why is there a consolation, a nechama? So Rabbi Shlomo Karlbach, who I learned from personally, Zatzal, teaches that there was and continues to be a tearing apart, a division, a separation. That's the word over here, either perud or hafrada. A separation, a conflict of sorts between the aleph and the bet in Av. What is the aleph? So the aleph is the first letter of the first word of the Aseret HaDibrot, of the Ten Commandments. So the Aleph represents, it's the metaphor to teach us about our Judaism, specifically our Judaism. Because that's the first letter of the word Anochi in the Ten Commandments, in the Aseret HaDibrot. The Bet is the first letter in the first word in the Torah, when the world was created, Bereshit. So hence, the Bet represents the world at large. So what is the tearing apart? What is the conflict? What is the Perud or the Hafradah? It's when we are torn apart, when we are struggling, when we are confused between living a life of Torah, that's the Aleph, and living in the world, which is the Bet. And we feel at times we have to choose either the Aleph or the Bet. Between being a Jew and being human. That's the conflict. That's the inner fragmentation. The idea of Beviat HaMashiach, of the coming of the Messiah, individually, nationally, globally, is the process by which there is a consolation, a mending of sorts, a tikkun, a rufu'ah, between the Torah and the world. This is the consolation of the Av. This is the Menachem Av, the Father. Hence we learn in Yerushalmi, in the Gemara Yerushalmi, in the Sechet Berchot, also in the Midrash in Eicha Rabbah, chapter 151, that the Mashiach was born on Tisha B'Av, Dafka on Tisha B'Av. The latter also mentions in Midrash Eicha Rabbah that, guess what the name of Mashiach is? Menachem. That's the Menachem Av. So I'm talking not the person necessarily, but the energy, the consciousness of Menachem, of bringing comfort, of bringing unity, of bringing a sense of repair and healing to the brokenness. Hence, within Tisha B'Av, the potential exists for a transformation from breakage to healing, from galut to geula. Now the question remains, and I offer this to all of you. It's a rhetorical question at this point. I hope by the end of the lecture you'll have an answer. The question is, will the Aleph become absorbed into the Bet? Will the Bet become absorbed into the Aleph? Or will there be some, what we call shiluv? The word shiluv is over here, an interlacing, where they both remain what they are, but they come together. It's a question to think about, to ponder. Now, the word gola, gimel vav lamed he, means exile. It means diaspora. It means disconnect. It means fragmentation. Fragmentation, as you can see here, the word fragmentation is mukutat, or nishbar, shivira. There's a breakage, there's a fragmentation. According to the Baal Shem Tov, what is that? What's the cause of that? It's the absence of the Deat Hashem. It's the absence of knowing God in your life and seeing that in the world. So when there's a vacuum, when one does not sense God's presence in the world, spiritually, I'm not talking about the physical galut of living out of Israel, or when the Romans destroyed the second temple and forced us into galut, or the Babylonians, the first temple, that's a physical. I'm addressing the spiritual here. It's a consciousness that one can actually be estranged from oneself, which is what the Baal Shem Tov comes to teach us, is the spiritual definition of gola. Now, the word geula, which is redemption, it's very interesting that the word geula is the same spelling as gola, except for one letter. The Aleph, exactly. That goes back to the one. Aleph is gematria one, and the number one begins with an Aleph. So what happens when we restore, into this absence of a consciousness of God, of a godly consciousness, with a godly consciousness, we are redeeming ourselves. We are redeeming that part of the Dalet Amot that we're living in the world. The aura that we share by ourselves, with ourselves, and with each other. So hence, the Aleph, which equals Echad, when a Jew's consciousness is not a godly consciousness, the Jew is in the spiritual galut and senses fragmentation and division in the world. So it really behooves all of us to really ask for within ourselves to bring redemption in a spiritual sense. I'm not talking about the person on the white donkey going down by the Rekabat Kala, going to Shar Yafo. That's a whole different midrash. I'm not saying it's not true, but that's not what I'm talking about. All right. Now, the name, it's interesting, the name Yisrael, this is also part of the context to understand the text. The name Yisrael, which is found in Bereshit, in the book of Genesis 32:29,
Interesting, that is chapter 32, which is Lamed Bet, which is Lev. So in the very heart of the book of Genesis, even though we know that the division into chapters and verses is not of a Jewish source, still there is some divine providence to that. So in the very heart of Genesis, we see after Yaakov wrestled with, according to the very many interpretations, a force, an angel, God, him, her, itself, right before this force departed, what did this force say in the verse? Your name will be changed from Yaakov to Yisrael. And why? What does Yisrael mean in the pasuk? Kisarita im Elokim ve'im anashim v'tuchal. Meaning, you have sarita, you have struggled. You have struggled with God and with people, humankind, and you have prevailed. Now, when you have struggled with God, that's your spirituality. That's your Aleph. And when you struggle with humankind, the world, that's your Bet. So this struggle goes all the way as far back as Yaakov. And that night, he redeemed his own sense of galut. So hence, the meaning of the pasuk is profound because it defines who we are. We are called B'nai Yisrael. We're not called B'nai Yaakov. Even though we are B'nai Yaakov, we are B'nai Yisrael. We are descendants of people who struggle. So I hope I don't disappoint you by saying struggle is a Jewish reality. However, we are guaranteed in the pasuk that if we really struggle with the Aleph and with the Bet, when we're struggling with this, we will prevail. And that's the key. That's the operative word here, v'tuchal. You will prevail. I mean, how many people can go into the boxing ring and be guaranteed they're going to win? Hashem is saying, all I'm asking you to do is take those parts of you that are at odds with each other and sincerely and genuinely struggle with it. And then you will come up with an answer. The first part is note taking. No. Okay. So to continue, so now we understand the name Yisrael. Are there any questions up until now? I'm ready to hand out the text. Yay! All right. But I hope that this context of oneness will enhance and really enrich your experience as we move through the text. All right. And as one of my teachers always said, please do not go beyond page one of the text. Please, please. Oh, and I forgot to mention, at the end of the lecture, please remember to turn your cell phones back on. That's a positive way of saying, you know what. Okay. Okay, this is a text. As it's being distributed, I want to tell you a little bit about the text. It's an English translation. It's Bekitzer. It's a short adaptation of about a 30, 40-page piece of Hasidic discourse, spiritual discourse, written by the 5th Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1899 in the town of Lubavitch in Russia. And his name is Rav Shalom Dovber of Lubavitch. His nickname, we call him the Rebbe Rashab. Now, this adaptation of his discourse, which he delivered on Simchat Torah in 1899, is based on a pasuk from last week's Parsha.
Is there any more, or we need to share? Because we don't have
any. Oh, really?
You should share. No. Oh, there was more. Okay. Sorry.
That's every teacher's both dream and nightmare. It's a paradox. Yeah. Well, there was a good showing. I ran out of sources. But that's not good. Especially if you're the one that doesn't get one. Right. Does everyone have? Okay, so I want to discuss what this is based on. The pasuk. It's actually a pasuk from last week's Parshat Matot. And this Parsha Matot always occurs in the 3 weeks, so it's very timely. And it's found in the book of Numbers 31:3. You won't have that on your source sheet. What you do have is, you see where it says, based on the spiritual discourse, Hechatzu, Hechatzu? Does everyone see that? Right? The word hechaltsu is a word from the pasuk. Does anyone know what hechaltsu means? It means to arm, to become armed. So here's the verse. The verse, I'll say it in Hebrew, then I'll say it in English, then I'll say it in Hebrew. Moshe spoke to the people saying, arm men from among you for the army, so they may be against Midian to cause Hashem's vengeance against Midian. So it was a command to arm the people who were going into the army to fight this war. By the way, this was the last war before he passed away. So we know it's around Adar time. In Hebrew, I'll read in Hebrew. It's good to hear the original Hebrew. Even if one doesn't understand all the words, your soul does. V'yedaber Moshe el ha'am lemor. Hechatsu mi'itchem anashim letzava. V'yu al Midian. Letet nikamat Hashem b'Midian. So my question to you, from a spiritual, not a strategic, military, political, obvious sense, but from a spiritual point of view, be creative here, and I have two questions. What do you believe Moshe is telling us to arm ourselves with? And what is the revenge? What is the revenge for? Now, before you answer, before one or two people may suggest an answer, I would like to share with you from the actual Ma'amar, from the discourse. These are the words from the Rebbe Rishab. He says, Midian, the country Midian, the people Midian, the whole matter of Midian comes from the word Madon. Does anyone know what Madon means? Madon means strife, conflict, quarrel. It's also, Midian means sinat chinam. That's a phrase we hear a lot during the three weeks, and now we're in the 9 days. This, the spiritual meaning of Midian, goemet peirut. It causes, what does it cause? Separation. It causes division. Sinat chinam sifta hayishut. Now the reason there is the sinah, the reason there's the separation, is what we call yeshut. It's a very big concept in Kabbalah. Yeshut, which is down here. Yeshut means ego. It means I am. I am to such a point that there's nobody else. So this whole room is me. That's the epitome of yeshut. So if there's, I don't know how many people are in this room right now, 20, 25 people, whatever. If everyone feels that the whole room belongs to them, there's very little room for people to really honor and hold the other. This is the danger of Yeshut. So Midian from Madon is this sense of, it's all about me all the time. Therefore, it breeds. It breeds Peirut. It breeds the separation and division. And this is against Ze Neged, he says, the Rebbe Rishab says, Ze Neged Bitul. Now, Bitul Yeshut. Bitul literally means, like Bitul Batal B'Shishim. Does anyone know the phrase Batal B'Shishim? What does Batal B'Shishim mean?
When you have a certain unknown amount, and when 60th of it is in there, then it's still okay.
Yeah, like the typical example of a drop of milk goes into the vat of chicken soup, right? So, if it's less than a 60th, it's batal b'shishim. It's as if it doesn't exist. But bitul yeshut does not mean we should disappear. That's not what it means. It's the spiritual practice. It's the spiritual practice of going beyond the ego, becoming part of something larger than myself. So then instead of me owning this whole room, meaning, i.e., there's no room for anybody else in my life, I become part of something much larger. So instead of losing myself, I actually discover another piece of myself by trusting that process of bitul yeshut. This is one of the biggest concepts in Kabbalistic literature, and this is part of redemption. One cannot redeem oneself from one's inner fragmentation between the Aleph and the Bet if it's always all about me. Now, there are times we need to take care of ourselves. I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I need to go to the Shiur team, I need to have the right amount of sleep. There are times where we need to think about ourselves. But it can't be a way of life 24/7 in its proper place. And that's bitul yeshut. So it's not to totally nullify the drop of milk in the vat of chicken soup. It's to become part of something larger, the way the drop of milk becomes part of something larger than it. Did you have a question?
I just can't see,
but... okay. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, can... I did the best I could with what I have. So, but please, if you can't follow a word, let me know, and I'll be more than happy to read it for you. Okay, so that's what the Rebbe Rishab says. So what do you think we're armed with, and what is the revenge? If Midyan, spiritually, is the consciousness of separation, of yeshut, of egocentric behavior, what is Moshe saying, arm yourselves, according to the Rebbe Rishab, the spiritual arming? Can anyone be brave? I hope I've provided a safe space, but I want to go beyond the safe space and create a brave space.
So I guess it's arming yourself to work together.
Yeah, it's a consciousness, exactly. Exactly. That's always been our strongest armament. Yeah. You know what our neshek is? You know what neshek is? Who knows what neshek? What?
Ammunition.
The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zechet Tzadik Lebracha, said that it's a Rosh Tevot from Neirot Shabbat Kodesh. So we have weapons, we have arms. It's a consciousness. It's a way of being in the world. And what is the revenge? We're taking, the Pasuk actually says to take revenge, God's revenge against Midian. What would be that revenge? You want to take a guess? It's to restore unity to a fragmented world. God did not create the world for the world to be fragmented. But Midian is not only the country, it's the consciousness that represents fragmentation, separation, arguments, strife, division. So what Moshe is saying is, take revenge. Put unity into the world. That's the war with Midian. That being said, let's jump now to the actual text. This is the adaptation. I'll just read. We usually think of the cosmic struggle in terms of good versus evil. But according to the Mekubalim, according to the Kabbalists, good and evil are but spin-offs, the totsa'ot, of unity and divisiveness. Achdut, which is unity, and divisiveness, separation, disunion, peirud or hafradah. According to Kabbalah, that's the real struggle, the cosmic struggle. God is the ultimate oneness, echad, and everything godly in our world bears the stamp of God's unity. Evil, simply stated in this context, is the distortion of this oneness by the veil of divisiveness in which God shrouds his creation. So it's like pulling the curtain away, you know, in The Wizard of Oz. Like, when you look out at the world, we do see a lot of peirud and hafradah. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that. So our goal, we hope, is to be inspired enough to pull the curtain back and see what's really going on behind that. So creation, following now back in the text, as described in the teachings of Kabbalah, is an evolution. What is creation? It's an evolution from the utterly singular, that's yachid, the utterly singular, to the plural and dichotomous, to ribui or rabim. So it's going from yachid to ribui or rabim. That's from point one to point two. The entirety of existence originates as the divine yen to create. And we don't know why God has this desire to create, other than to teach us that he is the source of creation and he has actually bequeathed in the way we have been created to create. Like all of us need to have a fulfilled life, we need to change something in the world that expresses who we are. And that's a yen to create. And this desire is as singular as its conceiver. But latent in this desire, it's one desire from one creator. But latent in this one desire is also another face of the divine. It comes with a challenge. The infinite possibilities implicit in God's unlimited potential. So guess what? When God created, quote, the world, it's not just the world. God created different colors, different textures, different shapes. I mean, just look around this room. Just look at all the different books, the colors of the books, the size of the books, the tables, each other. So even though it was one yin, one desire from the one God, creation took on diversity. Here we have the word diversity, muguvan or givun. Does that word at all sound familiar to anyone where it has another meaning? Ligaven means to color. To color. So the world is in color. It's not just black and white. Wasn't there a movie about that?
Pleasantville,
yes. Exactly. The world is not all about black and white. The world is mamash, mukuvan. I mean, we say in English diversity, and then color is a whole different word. But in Hebrew, the word to color with different shades, and mukuvan is in the same sharash, gimel vav nun. So thus, the singular desire for creation gives birth to a plural world. A world whose immense detail and complexity bespeak the infinite potential of its creator. So hence we have plurality, which is Rav Goniut. Now Goniut comes from Meguvan, and also this is from the Rebbe Rishab's actual discourse. He uses the word Hitchalkut. What word is in Hitchalkut? Chelek. Now here, segmentation is not a negative judgment. It just means that the world is made up of pieces of a puzzle, of segments. That's the Hitchakut. Now, none of this, in and of itself, is the negative phenomenon that we call evil. It isn't. Yet, the seeds for evil are here. Do you see that? That the seeds for evil, meaning, as we've defined evil up above, hafredot, there's a potential to go in that direction, people. There's a potential for that. Plurality can beget divisiveness. And divisiveness begets madon, midyan, conflict. As long as a plural reality still echoes its singular source, though, divisiveness will not take root and will not spawn strife. Does everyone understand that? If there's someone that doesn't get this bolded sentence, please, this is a good time to raise your hand. This is a key part of the discourse. Yes, yes. So as long as, when I look at all the different sizes of these books and all the different colors of the covers, I see behind it the same creator. When I look at all of you, different heights, different weights, different genders, different expressions of humanity, you're all wearing different, there's no two articles of clothing the same. Everyone's wearing a unique outfit. I could look at a world that's fragmented, that's divided. However, if I go behind that, I see that all of us are created by the same God, equally in Tzelem Elokim. Nobody here in this room more than me, and no one less than me. And every one of you can say that. So there's a unifying force within the diversity. With the development of each particular entity in the diversity of creation into a self that is distinct of the cosmic whole, divisiveness, strife, or evil can rear its head. So that's where there's a potential. That's where there's a potential for the strife. But you know, there's a phrase that we learn from the rabbis in Gemara, that the refuah always precedes the machala. The healing always precedes the sickness, the disease. Without this potential to go in this direction, we would never have the potential to go in the other direction. There's a phrase in Mishle, Ze l'umat ze asa Elokim et ha'olam. God made everything, l'havdil, we could say, yin-yang. Like, as much as you can go this way, you can go this way, because that creates the balance. So if a person is very passionate about this, a person can equally be passionate about that. Just sometimes that this is good and that is not good. So here, we could take this diversity in the world, the plurality, the rav goniut, the maguvan, the givun, the hitzchakut, and we can go in one of two directions with this. This is where we come in, chevra. This is where the human being, up until now, the human being has no say. This is how the world has been created. So the question is, how does one restore the back into the text, how does one restore the divine unity to a fragmented world? Guess what? By delving further into its plurality. This is the biggest secret, chevra. The more we honor each other's diversity, the more we can hold plurality, guess what? Under a microscope, and quantum physics is actually backing this up, the more we have in common, not the less we have in common. This is pulling the curtain apart. This is the paradox of life. The more something is broken down to its particulars, the more we uncover opportunities for unity. So, there are two examples. I'm only going to read one example here. And the example that's in the actual Hebrew is fire, esh v'mayim. Fire and water. Now, if you look at fire and you look at water, can anything be more opposite and different and separate from each other than fire and water? Your five senses perceive them as different and unconnected. But place them under a microscope. If you really analyze fire, and you really analyze water, you will discover they are comprised of similar components. They might even share a common element or two. The deeper you delve, descending to the molecular, atomic, and subatomic levels, the more unanimity you will find. And the more ways you will discover to harness these diverse substances toward a singular end. So what looks very opposite, really deep, deep, deep inside, has much more in common than we see at a first glance. Thus we introduce a new factor into the cosmic equation. Harmony. Guess how to say harmony. Who knows how to say harmony in Hebrew? Can anyone read my Hebrew writing?
Harmonia.
Yes, harmonia. Right? The Rebbe Rashab uses the word hitkalalut. Hitkalalut from klal means general. Hitkalalut is the state of integration. So what we can do as a human being with our free will, we can take this reality that we have nothing to do with. This is the stage upon which Adam and Eve entered into the cosmos. However, this is now our responsibility, and this is how we can redeem ourselves and the rest of the world. We can take this and go in one of two directions. So before I read further in the text, I just want to briefly review these terms. This is peirud, separation. This is madon, strife or dispute. And that's the word Midian, the country Midian, comes from that. Nishba or shvira, fragmentation. Mukuta is fragmented. Yeshut, that sense of I. Like, you all don't exist in that. It's I. It's all about me. Or we can go the other way. We can go into hitkalalut, integration. Harmonia, shiluv. Shiluv is beautiful because in a real state of shiluv, nothing really loses its unique properties. It's like a tapestry. That's what's beautiful about a tapestry. The different colors, the different weavings, the texture, the density. But it all comes together. Integratia. That's a new Hebrew word for some of you. Integratia, integration, right? Shalom. We say shalom means peace, but what does shalom really mean? Whole, completion. Exactly. That's why we say when we pay for something, ani meshalemet. Geveret, that shilamt kvar. Did you pay already? What does that have to do with? Because we're completing the sale. Here, bitul yeshut, that is the remedy against yeshut. So these are our two choices, chevra. This is where bechira chofshit is very, very important. There are no victims in this theater of operation. So back into the text. We introduce a new factor into the cosmic equation, harmony. We evolve from the ultimate singularity, from this point over here, to plurality, over here, to diversity, which is over here. But diversity need not disintegrate into strife. It can, but it doesn't have to. Instead, the diversity can be further dissected into the ingredients of harmony, a harmony that mirrors the singularity out of which the entire process was born. So in the words of the Rebbe Rishab, this is what he says, Emitit ha-hit kalalut, kishapratim einam menagdim. He says that the state of hit kalalut, that's the integration, true integration is when the particular parts are not against each other. They're not fighting each other. The adaraba, to the contrary, misayim zelazet, they actually help each other. They actually help each other. So therefore, the hitchakut, the segmentation of the world, the plurality, actually can lead to harmony and integration. And that's where we come in again. So an example that I'd like to share with you is a symphony, an orchestra that plays a symphony. Now, if you were to go to a symphony, and you're all excited, this is going to be your favorite classical music, you paid for the extra, the better seats, seventh row center. I don't know where I learned that term from, but seventh row center is supposed to be the desired row, right? And you're all excited to hear the symphony, Beethoven, whatever it is, Tchaikovsky, whatever. And the curtain goes up, and you see before you 50 violinists, or 50 oboists, or 50 trumpets. What would you be thinking to yourself? What?
Something's wrong,
because they're all the same. They're all the same. See, the word here, you didn't see the word same. The beauty of a symphony, of an orchestra that is playing Beethoven, is the multiplicity, the diversity of all the different musicians. So the oboist is true to playing the oboe, which is different than playing the violin, which is different than playing percussion. What's keeping them all together? The one piece of music with the one conductor. And they are literally on the same page. You see, that's what God is asking of us. There's this symphony in the world that creates, and you know when that orchestra starts, I remember a friend of mine, when I was teaching in Seattle for a few years, we went to, I think it either was a symphony or a ballet, and we were talking about this discourse, not as in detail as I'm teaching it tonight, but I think like the week before we went, this is what we were talking about. And then the music started. And the harmony, the music was stunning. And she, like this, she said, Iska, I'm about to cry. This is what we were talking about. The sound of that harmony is not just the violin. It's not just the oboe. It's not just the percussion. It's a new sound. It's a different, it's a unique sound of the harmony of everyone coming together. That's the shibud. Because each instrument, in the words of the Rebbe Rishab, is helping the other. There, each one becomes a resource for the other. Imagine if we lived in a world like that, where like, you're different than me. You're different than me. I'm different than you. How can I help you be more you? And please ask me how you can help me be more me. So I'm the oboist, and you're the violinist. So you don't threaten me as an oboist, and I don't threaten you as a violinist. That's only when we are when we really go down into the Yeshut, where it's only and always about me. We just have such a limited consciousness. This is more of an expanded consciousness. That's what we call this redemptive Torah, because it's redeeming us from that. Okay, any questions up to here? You're all with me?
Yeah.
Great. Now, a harmonious world however, does more than just reflect the tranquil singularity of its origins. It reaches beyond it to uncover a new, hitherto unexpressed face of the divine reality. Life on earth is more than the endeavor to come full circle to undo creation by restoring it to its primordial unity. That's not what this is about. This is about introduce something different that only the human being who was created by God for this purpose can do. The descent from singularity into diversity is an investment. It's a hashka'ah, we say in Hebrew. And God expects to realize a profit from his outlay. You know what the profit is? It comes from us. The profit is harmony, which you can't have pre-creation because everything's one, outwardly and inwardly, which is deeper. The harmony is a deeper, it's a truer expression of the divine unity than the pre-creation singularity. Do you get that? Clever, that's a very important statement. I mean, it's what? That the Rebbe Rishab was able to teach this in 1899, in the time of Lubavitch, to a world that was suffering so much from being fragmented. I don't know more or less than we are, but we're also suffering from fragmentation. And that's what this is teaching us. This is an active relationship. We're in partnership with God. We've been given a mandate to really create change. We are agents of change. We're agents of redemption. Everyone here is Mashiach in this sense. Everyone here is Mashiach. If there is one phrase that encapsulates the Jewish faith, it's the Shema Yisrael. The verse recited by the Jew every morning and evening in a person's life. And the last words to issue from one's dying lips. But why, ask our sages, does the verse employ the Hebrew word echad to connote God's unity? The word one can also be used to refer to something that is one of a series. One, two, three. So what do we say? Why don't we say God is the only one? Or unified? Why do we say one? God's unity transcends such oneness. It's not that there's one God and not two gods. It's much deeper than that. As Maimonides of the Rambam states in his introduction to Mishnah Torah, would not the Hebrew word yachid, back over to here, singular, would not that have been more appropriate? Well, evidently not. But it's worth asking the question. Singularity, to say that God is singular, would not introduce what this teaching really is about. Because singularity is a challengeable oneness. A oneness that may be obscured by the emergence of plurality. Do you understand that? That's crucial here. It's not that God is the only God. By the way, there were people before Avram and Sarah who believed that their God was the only God. It's not that they sensed that there's only one God in the world. They sensed that the one God is one with everything. That what we see as distinctly different from each other is just a false illusion. That God is everywhere, here, there, and everywhere, up, down, right, left, and all around, as the song goes. As we have seen, when God's infinite potential is expressed in the countless particulars of a diverse creation, this results in the concealment of his oneness, the life endeavor of the Jew, and this is our mandate, is to effect a truer expression of God's oneness. The oneness of Echad, not Yachid. It's not about singular, it's the opposite. It's within the plurality to see oneness. Echad is the oneness of harmony. One orchestra, one symphony, one conductor. Echad is the oneness of harmony, not a oneness which negates plurality, and which plurality therefore obscures, but a oneness that employs plurality as the implement of unity. I have a note here that I'm reflecting on this and talking this over with a colleague. I began to realize that we Jews, you know what we've been chosen for when we say Asher Bachar Banu Mikol HaAmim? That God has chosen us from all of the peoples of the world. For what? For our capacity to understand oneness. And then to introduce this to the world, to inform the global narrative with this truth. This is what we're here for. This is what we've been chosen for. So now, we see that there were three divine echoes. Ultimately, the unknowable, the indefinable essence of God transcends and embraces both singularity and plurality. God's not within the confinement of either of those, but God created that. So our reality cannot really, no reality can totally express his quintessential truth. But it can. What we can do is express certain elements of it. We can express elements of his truth, which includes by virtue of its non-definitive all-inclusiveness. We can actually express to the world the paradox, the ultimate paradox of living in this world. And that's where the real living is. It's not shechov lavan. It's mamash. It's when we say meguvan, it is colorful. Because there's infinite, infinite amount of expressions. So, in summary, three such elements find expression in the various stages of creation. And you'll see how I introduce this into the Shema meditation. Great. Right on time. Good. First is God's singularity. That's expressed in the featureless, objectless reality that precedes and transcends and pervades creation. Then there's God's potential, expressed in the vastly particular world that God created. Then there's the divine harmony that we manifest by effecting a synthesis and unanimity of purpose in God's diverse creation. Of the three, harmony is the deepest expression of God's truth. For its echad, its oneness, embraces the polar phenomena of singularity and plurality, expressing the truth that the divine reality cannot be confined to either mode of being. When the human being, confronted with a fragmented and strife-torn world, and I emphasize here either one's inner world or the world that we are a part of at large, responds by extracting the potential for harmony implicit therein, the person elevates creation beyond its singular plurality. Beyond even its singular origins, fashioning it into a model of the quintessential unity of its creator. So, with that in mind, that's the end of the text. The pasuk, the verse, Shema, now becomes, this is the tikkun, this is the fixing, this is the refuah, the healing, this is the nechama, this is the comforting for the tearing apart, going back to what we said earlier, of the aleph and the bet. That's present within each one of us. You don't have that. Back to taking notes. I didn't want to give you everything on a printout, because then I would lose you. So you can jot down that the Shema now, as I'll go over with you word by word, and we'll do a meditation together. You don't have to worry about going into a whole nother consciousness. I mean, it should only be. But at least we'll have an introduction into that, right? But it's important to understand that the word, that the phrase Shema Yisrael is not just, remember in the beginning of the lecture I asked, can a few people suggest what it means to them? And the three of you all said something profound. And now we see something also profound. That in addition to what the three of you said, we see the Shema as a refuah, as a tikkun, as a nechama. Between the aleph and the bet, that struggle that Yisrael struggles with God and with humankind. Now what Shabbat is to the week, that's what the recital of the Shema is to the day. It's important to remember that guess where the Shema is found? What parsha? Does anyone know what parsha? Ve'etchanan. And when do we read Ve'etchanan every single year? The Shabbat after Tisha B'Av. So every year, just like right before Tisha B'Av, during the 3 weeks, we read about Midian and going to war. arming ourselves with a consciousness to fight separation after Tisha B'Av, along with the Haftarah of Nachamu, Nachamu, we read the Shema. The Shema is the way to restore. We even see a textual connection between the Shema in the Parsha and the Nechama in the consolation of in the Haftarah. So now, we're going to do the actual Hitbonenut, the self-reflection, the meditation, on the Pasuk of Shema. Okay. What I'm going to do is tell you the meaning of each of the words. And I really had to stop myself from giving it in a handout. I really want you to write down what you're hearing, each of the words. And then we'll actually do it together. Before I go further, though, with the actual Shema, does anyone have any questions, insights, please, in the back?
Yes, thank you. On page 3 under the investment, it says the descent from singularity into diversity is an investment. So I was wondering about the word descent, because I would have thought that it would be a going up from singularity into diversity to get closer to unity.
That's okay.
On the last page it says elevate, and that's the word I would look for there.
Okay, so there's a phrase in Hasidut, in the spiritual teachings, Yeridah Shetzericha Aliyah. It's like jumping on a trampoline. You jump down to spring up. So if God started before the, if you can imagine, a moment before the creation of the world, which we really can't because there was no time till the creation of the world, but theoretically in our limitations, in our limited mindset, before the creation of the world, there was no physicality. So when God created the world, starting with light, the tohu v'vohu, the null and void, and the confusion, and the this, and the that, v'yi'er, v'yi'boker, yomar, the first day of creation, what that represents is a profound, profound descent of going from pure spirituality to pure physicality. We then take the pure physicality, and then we elevate it by revealing in it its spirituality. That's the jumping down on the trampoline to spring up. You're welcome. By the way, this what I love about this also, if I can share what I love about it, and I hope you can share also maybe what some of you love about this, it really honors physicality. Like Judaism is a way of life. It's a spiritual practice that honors the physical. We don't become more spiritual by negating the physical. We employ the physical to reveal the spirituality. It's a very healthy, at least, look, I'm Jewish, I can't help it. Like, I consider it to be a healthy way. I don't have to be a hedonist, but I don't have to be an ascetic either. I could really find the harmony between the two. Okay, so let's review what each of the words spiritually mean, and then we'll do it together. We'll say the Shema together. The word Shema, most of us think it means what? Listen or hear. And it does. It does mean hear, and it does mean listen. But it also means something else. In Tanakh, in the book of Kings, Kings 1, chapter 3, when Solomon, King Solomon, becomes king, there's a verse where God says, in a dream, God says, "V'yomer Elokim, Sha'al ma'eten lecha. Ask what I can give you." What do you think Shlomo HaMelech asked of God? God said, "Ask and I will give."
Gold. Did he say gold?
Wisdom.
Well, he didn't ask for wisdom the way we think of wisdom, and he didn't ask for gold. But it's interesting you said gold, because this is what he said, and then I'll show you in the verses how God responded. He said in verse Tet, in Pasuk Tet, I'll read it in English, then the Hebrew. The reason I do the English first is because those who are not fluent in Hebrew, when I read the Hebrew, you'll have a sense already of what it means. Okay, so in verse 9, this is what Shlomo HaMelech asks for. Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this, your people who are so great? Now in Hebrew, v'natata la'avdecha lev shomea Lev Shomea is an understanding heart. It's you hear with your heart. This is what he didn't ask to become wise in his mind. He asked to be able to hear people so he would understand them in his heart. Lishpot et amcha lahavin ben tov ra, ki mi yuchal lishpot et am hakaved hazeh. Who could really judge this people? And this is how God responded to him. So beautiful in terms of teaching a value, teaching a priority of a value. And it pleased the Lord that Shlomo had asked this thing, that he asked with the word Shema to really understand. And God said to him, because you have not asked, because you have asked this thing, and you have not asked for a long life, you have not asked for riches, that's the gold, for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but you have asked to understand, for Lev Navon, for an understanding heart, with a Lev Shomea, Shomea, to discern judgment. Behold, I have done according. God is saying to Shlomo, I will do according to your words. I have given you a wise and understanding heart. And the operative word that Shlomo HaMelech asked for was a Lev Shomea, not only a Lev Navon. So therefore we see that with Shema, it also means understand with your heart, quietly, mindfully, with intention, being present. And who is being asked to understand? Who is being asked to listen and hear? Yisrael. What's the Yisrael? The ego here is understanding the Yisrael within me. The struggle within me to bring resolution to the conflict between my spirituality, my Judaism, my Aleph, and my being a physical being in the world, my Bet. The struggle with God and with humankind. And Shema Yisrael, to trust that I can prevail. That's Shema Yisrael. Now, the first Hashem, when we say Adonai, that's the transcendent aspect of God. That's the unknowable, the infinite, the undefinable. That's the singular point preceding creation. What the Kabbalistic, what the Mekubalim, the Kabbalists call Soveiv Kol Amim. That's the force of God that surrounds all of creation. So if you could add everything up, God is greater than that. So what am I saying? That transcendental, that undefinable, it says in the Zohar, Ein Tefisa Beiklal, there's no grasping it. You know, when you grasp something, when I say, oh, I grasp the concept, it's like I'm grasping the pencil. I have the ownership over it. But what does it say in the Zohar? Ein tefisa beklal. There is no grasping the transcendental aspect of God. However, that same God, that singular point, remember the three echoes? When it comes into creating a world of plurality, diversity, that becomes our God, Elokeinu. Now when we say, like, this is my pencil, this is my phone, it means I have a connection with it. So when we say Elokeinu, it's ours, it's possessive. Can you imagine the holy chutzpah that I can actually say Elokeinu? Our God? As if it's a part of me? But it is. It is a part of me. It's a connection, it's a relationship. It's the visceral experience of God. It's the immanent aspect of God. God is the creator creating plurality, including me. I'm part of the plurality. This is the finite dimension in the world. This is what the Kabbalistics call, the Kabbalists call, Mamaleko Ami, filling up every crevice. Every little crevice in this room has a spark at the very least. The Arizal said in Kabbalah in the 1500s, it was radical. It was a radical Torah that he said, even in a stone, in a rock, is a spark of God. And in Gematria, the word Elohim equals ateva. The natural, ateva means nature. The word the nature is the same numerical equivalency as God. And what does the word teva come from? Does anyone know what the word teva? The word teva in Hebrew, where we first find it in the Chumash? What? No.
Nature?
But where do we see the word? In Shirat Hayam, in the song that Moshe sang, Az Yashir Moshe, when we cross through the Kriyat Yamsuf, and it refers to the Egyptians drowning, meaning they became absorbed by the water. So the water concealed them. Teva conceals, nature conceals God's presence. I'll tell you though, if you have a garden, I mean, I'm really into gardening, and every morning I go out, like at 6 o'clock in the morning, I go from plant to plant, from flower, and I talk to my flowers. And I notice growth. I see the differences. Some of you who have been to my house have seen my garden. I water them. I talk to them. I can't but help see God's presence in it. But that's part of the spiritual practice of what this is. But initially, if you just look at nature, you may not see God's presence in it. You may see something beautiful, like the sun was setting before we started tonight. It was a gorgeous view right over there. So when we say Elokeinu, we're saying Hashem, the Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, that so beyond is our God. And then, even more so, the second Hashem, the second Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, that's the harmony, that's the resolution, that's the higher aspect of God that includes both the infinite and the finite, the oneness of the transcendent and the immanent, that follows after the human being brings harmony to the fragmentation by revealing in thought, speech, and deed the oneness in the world, which is not the same as sameness. And what do we say about all of that? Echad. Hashem Elokeinu. So I'm asking, one part of me is saying to the other part of me, Yiska, the part of you that's struggling to resolve this, the resolution is that the out there is united with the in here. And that's the higher level. That's the elevation that you asked about before. Because there's a oneness, not a uniqueness, not a singularity. It's not yachid, it is echad. It's echad. It's the ultimate expression of who we are. As each one of us testifies, and you know, when you see the parchment, when you see in the Torah, or on the mezuzah, Shema Yisrael, the ayin in Shema and the dalet at the end are bigger. Why are they bigger? Because they spell the word aid. What is aid? Witness. When I say the Shema, in light of what the three people in the beginning said, and with the Shema being the tikkun and the refuah, I am a witness to my own life being able to restore unity into a fragmented world. And this is what Abraham and Sarah first understood. This was their chidush. Not that they believed that there was only one God. It was much more than that. So, before we do, we have, this is great, right on schedule. So if you were to look at a mezuzah cloth, at a piece of parchment, or if you look in the Sefer Torah itself, when you see the Shema, the letter Ayin in Shema and the letter Dalet at the end are larger. So they bolet, they stick out because they spell the word Eid, which means witness. So by saying it, I think someone here said that, I think it was, you said before about being witness to something.
By making an individual declaration, I was able to link myself to a communal narrative.
Yeah, and that's being a witness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the aid. That's the aid in the Shema Yisrael. And there's one more tradition we have when we say Echad, Duh. We emphasize the Duh, because the Dalet can look like a Resh. And if we say Acher, it changes the whole meaning altogether. All right, so I'd like to do the Shema with you. I'm not going to suggest that we say it out loud together. I want to give you time to go into yourself and to really say each word in light of this teaching. Can anyone suggest why when we say the Shema, we go like this? In light of what we've discussed in the past hour. Definitely, so we won't be distracted, for sure. There's even though an additional reason.
Think more of what we're saying.
To think more of what we're saying.
I learned you're supposed to visualize the words.
So we can visualize the words.
To go inside.
To go inside. You're all, everyone's correct.
You've got fingers. You can model one hand. Your little fingers. One hand.
Wow. That's beautiful. That is beautiful. And another reason, oh gosh, all these reasons are wonderful. And another reason, and I hope you think it's wonderful too, is that when I'm just walking through my day, I can see fragmentation. I can see disunity. I can see hafordot in the world. So what I do, before I go into the Shema, by going like this, then if I'm really doing what everyone here said, the five fingers with the one hand, and not being distracted and being able to visualize the words. Visualization is very important in Jewish meditation. What happens is, then when I look out, I see a unified world. The world, if you really say the Shema the way God intended us to say the Shema, then when you go like this, the world is different. It can't be the same as when you first went into the Shema. And that's why we have to say it a few times. In the morning, we say it at night, we say it before we go to sleep, because it's a constant anchor to remind us of who we really are and what our mandate really, really is. That's how we become the light to the nations. So let's do it. Let's spend a couple of minutes. I would recommend, this is from my meditation teacher, to sit in a comfortable position. Meaning, both feet should be on the ground so nothing falls asleep. And begin to take deep belly breaths. Now, for those who have never taken a deep belly breath, the way to know if it's a deep belly breath, most of us, most of the time, engage in shallow breathing up here. A deep belly breath, if you put your fingers like this on your belly button, when you inhale, without you moving your fingers intentionally apart, your diaphragm will actually move your fingers apart. And that's how you know you're breathing from deep down. And then when you exhale, they'll come back together as the diaphragm contracts. The reason we do this is when you can do this for 10 breaths, physiologically, there's a chemistry change. And to your point about distractions, you will be less distracted. So, let's spend a few minutes saying it. If you want to whisper it out loud, say it out loud, say it to yourself. Try to focus on these meanings that I was just sharing with you. It could really change profoundly your saying of the Shema. Okay? Are there any questions before we go into it? Oh, I just feel so blessed that during the 9 days I can share this with you, the real unifying meaning of Shema Yisrael. Okay, here we go. All right, a few minutes. I invite you to open up your eyes. Maybe see a little bit more harmony in the world, a little bit more oneness in the world, and within yourself. So in conclusion, is there anyone that would like to share their experience reciting the Shema this way, or any insights regarding the text, the ideas that I have been blessed and privileged to share with you? Any questions? You all have that glazed look. Wow, we did it. I brought some of my cards here to distribute. I have this private spiritual mentoring practice. As I said earlier, I'm a public speaker. I'm a member of the Jewish Speakers Bureau. We have the founder and director with us in the room, so she's the person to contact, Fern Rice, if you would like me to speak at any of your events.
And please feel free to take a card. And I'll be around for a few minutes if you have any one-on-one, one-off questions. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.